Om Namah Shivaya. Dear listeners of Shaivam.org, the next program is Spiritual Discourse. In this, you are about to listen Kawai Hindu Lectures. The titles are Karma Management and Why Bodhinatha Became a Hindu, and then Kawai's Love for Gurudeva, presented by Sri Shivaya Bodhinatha Velayatha Swami. Thank you. Om Namah Shivaya.
So, moving on, we have three final principles here for effective karma management. New ones to present. First one is called Accelerate Karma. Why wait 20 more births to achieve spiritual maturity when you could achieve it in 2 births? So, accelerate. So the idea is, if we're here and moksha is over here, maybe that's 10 more births, we can accelerate our karma, make it 8, accelerate our karma more, make it 5. That's what accelerate karma means. It goes by at a faster speed. So how do we make our karma go by at a faster speed? Well, Gurudeva explains that through daily sadhana, regular daily practices. So the key in daily sadhana is choosing the right amount, the amount that you can sustain, because everyone's very busy with life, occupation, family, education. It takes up a lot of our time. We don't have a lot of free time for sadhana. So we want to choose the right amount. If we choose too much, we'll do it for a while and we'll give up. We'll say we can't sustain it and we'll stop altogether. If we choose too little, we're not challenging ourselves. It's too easy. We're not making as much progress as we could. So we want to choose an amount that our situation in life enables us to sustain. And Gurudev also points out doing it at the same time every day is very helpful. So morning is the best time for a number of reasons. It's the best time to do sadhana for most people. Sometimes schedules don't allow it. But if morning is impossible, at least at the same time every day. That's the key. So we want to do it on a daily basis and at the same time every day. And then what happens? We're accelerating our karma. So different times of life are more conducive to this. So for those who are following the family path, it's traditional. After retirement, or after age 72, it's called the sannyasa ashrama. Doesn't mean one becomes a renunciate, just means one does more sadhana. It becomes a primary focus. It's a time that lots of people go on pilgrimage all the time, and because they don't have worldly responsibilities. They've gone through that. Their children are raised, their grandchildren are living, and so forth. So they have more time for sadhana. So retirement is opportunity to do more than play golf. It's a time to do more sadhana. And the benefits are we're accelerating our karma. So, of course, living in a monastery is also a good way to accelerate karma. So I thought of a marketing slogan for that. You know the one, join the army and see the world. So this is join the monastery and accelerate your karma. Join the monastery and accelerate your karma. So it's a good marketing slogan, right? See a little ad, join the monastery, accelerate your karma. I think it has potential. Turn it in for some graphics. So, Gurudeva's comment on that, accelerating karma. By this conscious process of purification, of inner striving, of refining and maturing, the karmas come more swiftly. Evolution speeds up, and things can and usually do get more intense. Don't worry, though. That is natural and necessary. That intensity is the way the mind experiences the added cosmic energies that begin to flow through the nervous system. So, just one comment on that. Sometimes this process is looked at in a negative sense. You know, gee, just want to get this thing over with. You know, this is, life is suffering and I'm not really enjoying things. And, you know, let's get it over with. Let's get to moksha quickly. Get this process over with. I'm tired of being unhappy and suffering and so forth. So that's not the way Gurudeva looks at it. You know, that Gurudeva's motto, of course, is life is meant to be lived joyously. And that means at all stages we try and be as happy and cheerful as we can. So the perspective that Gurudeva had on it is that as we get further along in our spiritual evolution, there's more going on the inside. We have more energies going through the higher chakras. So we're a more blissful, uplifted, wiser person because of that. So that's the advantage of accelerating it, not to get the whole thing over with because it's painful, but to move forward into the part that's more blissful, more wise, more enjoyable. Get there sooner. Moving on to our ninth principle. Our ninth principle is a little subtle. Resolve dream karma. What in the world does that mean? So it's a very interesting point. Gurudeva distinguishes between two kinds of experiences we have when we're asleep. One is what he calls a dream, meaning it's just something going on in our own mind. It's just a replay of impressions we've put in there in the past coming back in a creative way. Now, mind is very creative. You can put different things together in an infinite number of ways, come up with all kinds of dreams based on the same subconscious impressions. But the other kind of experience we have when we're asleep is what Gurudeva calls an astral plane experience, meaning we're actually meeting other people, but we're in our astral body. So to be able to distinguish between one and the other takes some explanation beyond what we have time for this morning, but Gurudeva gives a few guidelines. You know, if you reach out and you touch someone and they feel real, you wake up and you feel like you've met somebody you didn't know, things like that, you've probably had an astral experience. You've actually encountered other people. You're all in your astral body. So the idea is how we interacted with those other people counts. It's not like a dream where we're only in our own mind. We're actually interacting with other people. So we have to ask ourselves, did we act virtuously? Did we do something we shouldn't have? Just because it was a dream, we might have. We don't have as good a control over our instinctive nature in a dream as we do when we're awake. And nobody's watching. So we may have done something in an astral experience that we regret. So we don't want to ignore it because it has a karma. It has a consequence. It's real. It's just as real as something we do in the physical world. So, if we've done something we shouldn't, we need to compensate. We don't want to ignore it. It's possible to compensate in a further dream. You could go back in and apologize to the person, but that's hard to do. You can try, but unless you're really tied to that person, it's hard to end up with the same person. So, it's easier to do a penance in the first world, you know, something simple if you did something inappropriate, but to consider it a karma, to consider it real and not just forget about it. So Gurudeva's summary of that is, these kinds of dreams, when a person is in his astral body and can feel what he touches, emote to his experiences, think and talk, are not what is known as the dream state. This is an astral experience similar to the death experience, but the astral body is still connected to the physical body. So our last principle, the tenth principle, is called incinerate karma, meaning we want to burn it up. Something we don't want, let's burn it up. Let's get rid of it. Just like throwing something in the trash and burning it up. So again, a simple way of thinking about it is to compare it to seeds. So we take our alfalfa seeds, if we want to sprout them, We put them in a certain environment, right? Moist environment and so forth, sunlight, and they'll sprout very quickly. So if we want to cause those seeds not to be able to sprout, what do? We heat them up, right? Put them in a frying pan first, and then you put them in that environment and they won't sprout. If you heat them past a certain temperature, their ability to sprout is destroyed, right? We're all aware of that. So karma is the same way. That's what Gurudev is saying. Karma is the same way. If we focus on a certain karmic seed, if we can find it, and we can be in an intense inner state, the fire of the kundalini burns the karmic seed, so it won't germinate. Sounds pretty good, right? But that's why it's last. It's hard to do. Last but not least, but not necessarily the most important. Unless you're a monastic on tapas. So tapas means to burn, by the way. So the root of tapas is to burn. So one of the meanings of the word tapas is to try and generate enough inner fire to burn up a seed karma and therefore destroy it before it even manifests in any way whatsoever. So how in the world do you do that? Well, Gurudev explains. I'll just read it so we can all have some understanding. A meditation adept, having pinpointed the unmanifested karmic seed, can either dissolve it in intense light or inwardly live through the reaction of his past action. If his meditation is successful, he will be able to throw out the vibrating experiences or desires which are consuming the mind. In doing this, in traveling past the world of desire, he breaks the wheel of karma, which binds him to the specific reaction which must follow every action. That experience will never have to happen on the physical plane, for its vibrating power has already been absorbed in his nerve system. This same type of incineration can also happen during sleep. And Gurudeva summarizes it in this way. He says, it is the held back force of sanchita karma that the yogi seeks to burn out with his kundalini flame, to disempower it within the karmic reservoir of Anandamaya Kosha, the soul body. Well, this morning I don't have a major address, just a few simple thoughts. We're still all digesting everything we experienced during our inner search and our Satguru Pranima festival. So tell a few stories here. Stories are always nice. So as most of you know, some of our activities are community oriented. Gurudeva always stressed the importance of giving to the local community, not just taking from it, but giving back to it, helping in various ways, community service. So some of our activities involve meetings at which the mayor is present, Mayor Marianne Kusaka, and she's in her last few months of her term and a great supporter of Gurudeva. So we were at a meeting yesterday and she was there, and meeting for the island endowment that Gurudeva helped started Kauai Aloha Endowment, which is an endowment to benefit the island of Kauai. It's a fund at Hawaii Community Foundation. It is up to $100,000, small fund, but it's growing. It exists and it's doing its work. So we were at a meeting and the mayor asked the lady who was conducting the meeting, who's been on the island for a number of years, conducting seminars, very skilled person, have you ever met our Gurudeva? Those were her words. Have you, big smile on her face. Now, have you ever met our Gurudeva? Just the way she said it, you know, it just struck me and I had to think about it. And it showed the special place in her heart that Gurudeva holds. And then we went outside and You're talking to the doorman, and we started talking about Gurudeva, and he said, you know, when Gurudeva comes, he just gets out of the car, and there he is, and wow, you know. We were running into our local Gurudeva fan club at the hotel. So, which made me think, you know, what is it that impressed so many people on the island about Gurudeva? So I remembered a story, story that involves the mayor. Happened a few years ago, and the mayor was on county business in Seattle doing some promotional work. A lot of her work involves going around the world and trying to convince people to come to Kauai. She's going off to Japan in a month. So she was in Seattle, and it was a bit tedious, the work she was doing, and so she was on a break. So to enjoy her break and relax, she was shopping. She went shopping to have some fun and take a break from the tediousness of what they were doing. And she was feeling a bit discouraged at the moment, you know, because things weren't going as well as she had hoped, and she was tired and so forth. And so her phone rings. And who's on the phone but Gurudeva? I don't remember all the details, but for some reason Gurudeva felt compelled to call the mayor at that particular point, just to cheer her up, you know, I guess, was the idea. And so Gurudeva called and talked to the mayor, and the mayor never forgot that. Now, gee, Gurudeva somehow was so sensitive to my needs that he called me and cheered me up and made a big difference in the whole experience that we had in Seattle. So I think that's what many people on the island feel toward Gurudeva, that he encouraged them. He inspired them in whatever they were trying to do. It's not like he gave them something to do. You know, he wasn't going around, you should do this, you should do this, you should do this. No, people have things they want to do, things they're trying to do in their lives. And Gurudeva encouraged them, inspired them, re-inspired them to do those things successfully, to do them well, to keep trying, not to give up. Because quite often we face obstacles. Things don't go as easily as we had hoped. We experience difficulties we didn't foresee. And we become discouraged. We lose our inspiration. It happens all the time. So Gurudeva never lost his inspiration. He was always inspired. And he was able to encourage others, to re-inspire others in whatever they were trying to do. So I think that's, you know, one of the reasons that so many people on the island look to Gurudeva in the way they do, because he touched their life in that regard probably many times. In thinking about that, I remembered having reflected on the United Nations gathering. There was a gathering about 2 years ago, I think, of spiritual and religious leaders for world peace at the United Nations. So the name of the event caused me to think, what's the difference between a spiritual and a religious leader? Why do we have two words there? Why does it not say spiritual leaders or say religious leaders? No, it says spiritual and religious leaders. So whatever group named the event saw a difference between a religious leader and a spiritual leader. So what in the world is the difference? A spiritual leader is someone like Gurudeva who inspires you, someone who raises your spirit, lifts you up. That's a spiritual leader. So, for example, after September 11th, many people went down into the realms of fear. Some went into anger. You know, consciousness went down in many people because of September 11th. They're going along fine, but September 11th happened, and their consciousness went down. So a spiritual leader is someone who steps forward at a time like that and helps people bring their consciousness back up, so it doesn't go down first into fear, then into anger, and then into violence. It's going the wrong direction, right? Well, we want it to come up into understanding and compassion and wise action. We don't want to act from anger, we want to act from wisdom. So, that's another way of looking what I was talking about earlier, is the idea of inspiring people, encouraging people. It's an important quality in a spiritual leader. A spiritual leader is someone who doesn't get discouraged when the world falls apart. Things are not other than they should be to a spiritual leader. Things are always as they should be. He manages to hold that perspective that this is how things should be. Okay, nothing's wrong. This is how things should be. What do we do next? What's our next step? So it's a coming from a wise, stable consciousness. So all religious leaders aren't spiritual leaders. Religious leader is someone who's affiliated with a recognized religion. But all religious leaders don't have the ability to lift you up, or don't even have that concept that is something they're supposed to do, which is okay. That's not wrong. Some religions aren't trying to do that. So we can have religious leaders who are spiritual leaders and some who aren't. And we can have spiritual leaders who are religious leaders, meaning they're affiliated with a religion, and some aren't. So it's a very interesting way of looking at it. So that was yesterday. That's yesterday's story, encountering the mayor. We had a small glitch, and they tried to feed us some chicken for lunch. You know, didn't realize there were some vegetarians present, so they bring out all these plates and, you know, a piece of chicken sitting there in front of the monks, you know, and the mayor, you know, just, gosh, you know, she just went, whoa, you know, called the waiter over and said, you know, can't you make a nice salad? And do you have any tofu? You know, she was, you know, instructing the waiter what to do. That was very thoughtful of her. So another story, we went recently to Pittsburgh. There was a nice symposium there at which we spoke. Hinduism past, present, and future was a subject, and there was about 10 speakers and a impressive group of PhDs, most of them. Some were very, very insightful. Others were more theoretical. And what we spoke on was Hindu megatrends, which was a very interesting topic and is coming out in the next issue of Hinduism Today. We're updating our 10 Hindu megatrends. Remember, we published them about 12 years ago? So it's a way of looking into the future and ideally not just looking, but reflecting on the positive trends and the negative trends and taking advantage of the positive trends and trying to fix the negative ones. So ideally, we just don't look at it as a nice document, but Hindu leaders think on these trends and put them into use in a practical way. So one of the experiences was one of the participants in the seminar came up during a break, and he says, oh, you weren't born a Hindu. What made you adopt the Hindu ways? So that's a common question you get asked, and I always give the same answer. Well, Hinduism is an experiential religion. That's what I always say. It teaches you not just to believe in God, but to experience God. Not just to believe in the deeper truths, but to be able to experience them. And that's why Hinduism is so great. You know, that's what I always say. Standard answer. But in reflecting upon it, you know, I realized I needed to expand my answer. My answer was good, but hit the core of the matter, but it could be better. So I was thinking about that and added two more reasons. I'll share those reasons with you. It's joyous. How do you elaborate on that? But Yogaswami has a nice statement that goes into English. You know, you hear me quote it often. Bliss, 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 here, there, everywhere am I. That's how it gets translated, meaning he's experiencing God's omnipresence as himself. So it's a very profound but simple statement. So what are the first three words there? Bliss, right? So Hinduism takes us into a bliss consciousness. You know, we're not just denying ourselves and sitting there in hardship or something on a rock all day and hoping for something to happen. You know, it's taking us ever more deeply into a bliss consciousness. That's the idea. As Gurudeva said, you know, life is meant to be lived joyously, right? So that's one of the greatnesses of Hinduism, is it's leading us into our inner bliss. There's a nice word that we use in Dancing with Shiva, entasy, E-N-T-A-S-Y, instead of ecstasy, which is like outer bliss, this is inner bliss. Meaning we don't have to do anything to create it. Outer bliss, you have to do something to create it. If you're a child, you go on a roller coaster. Bliss, you know. You have to do something outside of yourself. So entasy means the bliss is inside, you just have to find it. You don't have to do anything. You just have to go deeply enough inside yourself to find it, inner bliss. It's there all the time. So sometimes we don't convey that joyous sense enough about Hinduism, particularly to children, to youth. And it's important. Sometimes the youth just encounter Hinduism as a strictness, as a set of rules. You can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this, and you got to get up and, you know, a bunch of rules. And the sense of joy isn't emphasized enough, but it should be. You know, we need to balance out the rules with a sense of enjoyment, with a sense of joy in the Hindu approach. So that's the second reason why Hinduism is so great. There's a third reason. In Gurudeva's terminology, it has a great collection of tools, techniques that we can follow. As Gurudeva said on the last inner search, I've given you all the tools, it's up to you whether you use them or not. It's like we just recently built a carpenter shop. It's got some of the greatest tools you can have for carpentry in this shop, but the shop isn't that valuable unless we build something, right? We have to use it. We have to have the skill, the knowledge to use the tools, and then we have to actually turn them on and use them and build something. So we're using it to build a shrine for Gurudeva back there in the corner, if any of you aren't aware of what we're doing back there. That's a shrine for Gurudeva that we're planning to finish by his Mahasamadhi. So it'll be ready by November. So we have a great collection of tools. The best collection of tools, techniques, to cause us to progress on the spiritual path. There is no tradition that has more tools than Hinduism. It's got more tools than you can use. You know, even just the trilogy, dancing, living, and merging with Shiva, you know, you won't be able to apply all those tools to your life. There's too many of them. But you know, you grab onto the ones that are the most important and use those, and you make progress. So it has a great collection of tools, of techniques to progress spiritually.